Coming up.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore, I am.
What goes on?
How do I know you're a fellow human being with a rich inner life like me?
I know I have a mind because I have direct access to it. But how do I know that you've got a mind?
Are you coming in?
No, no. I want to be alone with my thought.
What goes on in your heart? What goes on in your mind?
How do I know if anybody else really exists?
Are you alone?
Yes.
No. We are here with you.
Our guest is Anita Avramides, author of Other Minds.
What goes on in your mind?
Am I alone?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KAOW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Today, we're asking, am I alone? The problem of other minds.
Well, Ken, I know that I have a mind. I know what feelings, sensations, and thoughts I'm having. And I seem to know this in a very direct way. I don't have to make any inferences or guesses. I don't have to listen carefully to what I say to figure out what I think. But what about other people? Like you, for example. Can I really be sure that you have a mind like I do?
Come on, John. The way you looked at me, I could ask you the same thing, dude. I'm certainly not directly aware of those supposed thoughts and sensations and feelings of yours. So can I really know that you have a mind?
Well, at this point, I can imagine a listener thinking, oh my gosh, there go those philosophers again. What sane, rational person goes around doubting whether other people really have minds?
Well, that's why we're called philosophers. You know, look, you and I know that the philosophical problem of other minds isn't really a practical, everyday problem. You know, if you look at it, people are actually pretty good at figuring out what other people are thinking and feeling. Cognitive science actually teaches us that our capacity for mind reading, as they like to call it, may actually be hardwired into our brains.
Well, if cognitive science knows so much about it, what's left over for us poor philosophers to worry about?
Well, because we're trying to figure out something different. We're trying to understand the rational basis for our belief in other minds. I mean, we know that we do, in fact, believe in other minds. Not many people doubt that. But are we really justified in so believing? Does that belief even deserve to be called knowledge, John?
As opposed to what?
Well, as opposed to just a gut instinct, an instinctual hunch with no real basis in either reason or evidence or argument. That's what.
Well, a lot of our beliefs are just, you know, instinctual hunches without much basis. But it would be nice if our belief in other minds, which is pretty central to our picture of the world, rested on something a little bit better than an instinct or a habit.
Well, so here's an argument for you that it does, John, and I think you'll like this argument. Okay, it's called the argument from analogy. You're a human being, just like me. You behave in a lot like me, well, most of the time anyway. You use language in much the way I do. Well, I have a mind. So isn't it rational to suppose by analogy that you have a mind too? There you go.
No, it's a terrible argument. I mean, consider the sample size. There's 6 billion people in the world. You looking at one of them and said, oh, wow. This one has a mind, so everybody else does too. Imagine there's 200 cars on the freeway. They're all very similar. They all have four wheels. They all move in response to the way the drivers steer and the way the drivers accelerate, the way they brake. We notice that one of these cars has a box of Kleenex on the front seat, maybe our own. And so we infer all the others do too. That's absurd. Your argument about the 6 billion humans all having minds because you do is a million times more absurd.
Well, okay, let's try it another way, John. Suppose we look under the hood of the car and we find an engine inside and we think and investigate and we figure out that the engine explains why the car moves the way it does. Now, come on. Would you deny that it's a good inference that other cars probably have engines, too, and the engines probably explain the way they work, too? You wouldn't deny that, would you?
No, that's better. But now you're making what philosophers call an inference to the best explanation. All the cars move in certain ways. We figure out the right explanation, even if it's just for one of them. That's a big step. The right explanation is it has an engine. So other things being equal, that's the best explanation for the others.
So the same thing with minds. We know that other people have minds not on the basis of that risky analogical reasoning you were so dismissive of, but on something tried and true from the sciences, inference to the best explanation. We use it all the time.
Well, I've still got my doubts. Does inference to the best explanation really explain the degree of certainty that I hope you feel about my mind?
Well, why wouldn't it?
Well, because there's lots of different ways that minds might work. Take cars. In fact, nowadays, they don't all work the same. Some have electric motors rather than gasoline engines. Your mind and my mind could be as different as cars with different sorts of engines. Maybe I have a big, powerful V8 and you have a little hybrid.
Yeah, I get you. I can introspectively look under the hood of my own mind, as it were. But what then makes me so confident that your mind works the very same way that mine does?
Well, and to push it further, are you really so sure you even know very much about your own mind?
Oh, gosh, now that, you know, we question everything, and that's an assumption. The assumption that we know our own minds in a way that we can't know other minds, I guess that one does need to be questioned, too.
So we got a lot to think about, Ken.
Yeah, and to give us even more to chew on, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to talk to people who study the minds of children and the other minds they create. She files this report.
Before we're old enough to wonder whether everything around us is real, we first have to learn that everything around us is not us, that other people have their own thoughts. It seems kids understand relatively early that others exist. But then what does it mean when kids create worlds or people that don't actually exist? Imaginary friends.
Millie the Mermaid, she
is very best friend.
Yeah, and she loves to play with me, and she loves Chubby the Bear. And her tail is blue because she's a mermaid. And she also likes Vikings.
Children start to pretend around the same time they start to talk. Why would they do that? They have so much to learn about the real world. But right away, they're thinking about things that don't exist.
Psychology professor Marjorie Taylor at the University of Oregon has spent the last 20 years or so trying to figure it out.
At the time when I first started doing work in this area, there was a negative stereotype of children who had imaginary friends, the idea that they were sort of solitary children, maybe a little confused about fantasy and reality, maybe lacking real friends, that sort of thing.
And lots of times, when I play with it, I pretend it comes to life.
But Taylor's research doesn't support that stereotype. She finds the kids with imaginary friends aren't shy and have a solid understanding of reality and fantasy. Not only that, but in some areas they actually do better than kids without imaginary friends.
They tend to be able to take the perspective of another person, a real person, better than other children.
It seems the time they spend in the imaginary mind of another impacts their understanding of real minds, and might just improve their relationship skills.
When they're talking about their real friends, they're more likely to mention mental states, like beliefs, desires, and thoughts, and that sort of thing. So you see that they're more attuned, they're more thinking about mental life than other kids.
She's been with me since I was born, and she always got my back when I felt sad.
It appears these children are actually more social, or at least more socially attuned than others. So, what about adults?
People say, oh yeah, when I was a child I had a good imagination, but now I don't. People say that a lot.
But Taylor says it's not that simple.
Imagination is not something that's just about children. It's a very fundamental part of who we are. So we're constantly thinking in our own minds about how things could have been, really rethinking what's happened to us, planning for the future, living in fictional worlds through all the fantasy that in our everyday lives.
As far as we know, our lives are mostly real, but they're also always a little bit not real. Maybe it's not as easy to notice when the fantasies are about PowerPoint presentations rather than mermaids.
I tend to think of imagination as the capacity to mentally transcend your current time, place, and or circumstance. And that is something that we just do so routinely we don't even pay attention to it.
So the next time you catch yourself muttering out loud to no one, or see your child talking to an invisible friend in the corner, don't worry. Those habits actually help us make sense of what's in other people's heads, or at least what we think is in their heads.
Amelia the mermaid shall always be by your back.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie. I'm John Perry. I miss my imaginary friends of childhood, but I'm here with my non-imaginary fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And friend. And today we're asking about the minds of others, the problem of other minds. We're joined now by Anita Avramides. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Oxford. She's author of the very fine book, Other Minds. Anita, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Anita. This is a classic philosophy problem, but I'm going to ask how it came to interest you. Did you kind of have discover some of your best friends didn't really have minds and it was traumatic at some point, or some more mundane explanation?
Well, I don't know about this. What I can tell you is I was a pretty angst-ridden undergraduate, and I can be pretty angst-ridden even now. And part of that angst is feeling I'm not understood. People don't really get what's going on inside me. And I think a lot of people have that feeling. But that's not how I got into the philosophy. The philosophy I got into because I started thinking about it, and I started asking questions like, who first formulated this problem? Because I sometimes think it's a good way of learning about a philosophical problem to look at the history of it, get a grip on it. And every time I asked this question, people would say, I don't know. I suppose it was Descartes. Well, actually, interestingly, Descartes didn't write anything about this so-called problem of other minds, although I think he said a lot of stuff about minds and about knowledge that lead us to ask it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that I got from one of your articles. And of course, it goes slightly contrary to the way I've taught Descartes to freshmen for 40 years, but I think nevertheless you're right. But first, I want to start with something a little more systematic. In our everyday lives, we don't really seem to be too worried about what the people interact with have minds of their own. So we take it for granted that they have their own thoughts and feelings. And although I guess we're pretty good at figuring out what people are thinking or feeling, given the complexity of the human mind, we're often wrong about that. But we very seldom doubt that they have minds. So given it, even Descartes didn't worry about this. Why did philosophers start worrying about this?
Well, I said that Descartes didn't worry about it explicitly in his writing, but he did say, I think, therefore, I am. Mm-hmm. And he made some observations about his thinking. He said it was private, and he said he could be utterly certain that he was thinking and feeling things. And he said it was indubitable that he was thinking and feeling these things. It's almost as if he had this idea that he could kind of close his eyes and shut out the whole world, including other people, and just know that he had a mind, okay? But when you look out at the world, you see other people behaving, right? You see them acting in certain ways. And you can't know that they have a mind in the same way you know you have a mind. So already we've got a bit of a problem. And here's one problem. I said, I know my mind in a really particular way. I can't doubt it, or at least that's what we get from Descartes. But I can doubt other people.
Right.
I can doubt them in all sorts of ways.
So it's this asymmetry. And it's there. It's not just it may be it leads to a philosophical problem that ordinary people don't worry about, but all of us are faced with this asymmetry between our access to our minds and our access to other people's minds. And that's where the philosophical problem gets going, with this hard to deny brute asymmetry between our knowledge of our own minds and our knowledge of other people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's what I think is interesting in philosophy is you start out making some pretty, what seem like obvious assumptions, things you can't deny. And then you kind of step by step take yourself through that and see where you end up. Now, it seems to me that if you start where Descartes did, you really can end up in a pretty sorry place.
And that's this place
called solipsism.
Right.
Nobody else exists.
And we're going to have to see if we can avoid going into that dark
exactly,
place. Because if we can't avoid that, then our radio audience isn't out there. And I know that they're out there listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking about other minds. with Anita Avramides from the University of Oxford.
Are there any good arguments for other minds? Would your relationship with your spouse change if she or he weren't really sure you had a mind? Would you mind?
A mind is a terrible thing to doubt, so I don't want to doubt that you have them. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I know what it's like to be me inside my own mind, at least if I don't roll too many joints, I have a pretty good idea. But can I really know what it's like to be in your mind? I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, except today we're questioning whether you have a mind. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about the problem of other minds.
Our guest is Anita Avramides from Oxford.
So, Anita, earlier John and I sketched out these two traditional arguments for our knowledge of other minds, the argument from analogy, the argument to the best explanation. Do you personally think that either of these, or maybe some combination of these, is good enough to solve this problem?
I think the short answer is no. I don't think either of these arguments is pretty good. I want to say a plague on both your houses.
Okay, let's take them one by one. So why do you think the argument from analogy? That was kind of Russell and those guys. That was the first argument offered in the 20th century anyway about this stuff. Why do you think that's such a bad argument?
Well, actually, I'm going to approach this in a slightly different way. I'm going to say I think people nowadays think the argument from best explanation is a better way of approaching this, right? And they have this rather interesting argument. They say that they can avoid the problems that the argument from analogy hit, okay? So I'm going to tell you two kind of simple problems that the argument from analogy ran into, and then I'm going to try and tell you very quickly how the best explanation argument gets over it, okay? Here's one problem. The argument from analogy is generalizing from a single instance. And it's really bad because that single instance is just you.
Right.
Right? You have no experience of anybody else's mind. That's one problem.
That's the one I pushed in the intro.
Yeah. Okay, here's another problem. You're reaching a conclusion which is just uncheckable. I don't want to get into whether it's logically uncheckable or empirically uncheckable. We can't check it. Yeah? We just can't get in there and see whether you're right when you draw this analogy. Now, here's how the argument from best explanation claims to get around this problem. They say, look, all we have to do is look at another person's behavior and posit, you know, just hypothesize that they have thoughts and feelings like I do, okay? And if I make that hypothesis, then that explains what they do. And not only that, that can predict what they're going to do.
And that's a darn good thing, Anita. That's a darn good thing. That's how I believe atoms exist or whatever. I use an inference to the best explanation. I see the macroscopic behavior of water. I posit mechanisms in the water. I hypothesize. I check out the hypothesis. So what could be wrong with that?
Very interesting. I think there's a lot wrong with that. In fact, I think that once you push it in this direction, you can really begin to focus on what's wrong with these arguments. So you said that it's just like science. It's just like our reason for believing in, say, subatomic particles.
Right.
Yeah? That's a hypothesis. Right? And similarly, I look at behavior and I hypothesize and I explain and predict people's behavior. Okay? Now, I'm just going to say one small thing, which is I'm not sure the model of science is the best model for us to be using here. And I think that I'm going to give you a small reason for thinking this. And that is that I don't think we just want to explain and predict other people's behavior. That's not my only interest in you. I think that I want to understand you. I want to understand your thoughts and feelings. And as a result, I can get to understand myself a little bit better. And that's a pretty significant thing. I don't think I'm going to know myself in any particularly better way if I understand about subatomic particles.
Wait a minute, slow down. You're going too fast for me. Mm. Okay, look, I think I already, I mean, the argument, Descartes, go back to our buddy, our mutual buddy, mm-hmm. Descartes, you know, forebearer of us all, I, understanding myself by understanding you, I've got direct access to myself. My mind's an open book to itself. I don't need to understand you to understand myself. Aren't you kind of denying the starting point of this, that I have a kind of privileged access? What am I going to learn about myself by learning about John? I don't get that goal.
Well, you see, as I said, I think we do have to examine that starting point. And one of the things I think that starting point gets wrong is it makes it seem as if everything's so cut and dry over here in my mind.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think it's so cut and dry. I think there's a lot of shaping that needs to go on before I really understand what's going on over here.
Now, Wittgenstein, who was, the focus of my graduate education, said something like, look, in your case of your own mind, what gives you the right to be so sure what's going on in your own mind? Because when you use words to describe your own mind, you're actually only using words with meaning. If they have some more general application, you might think, well, I remember what was like to do this before, and now I'm doing the same thing. But then he has arguments that show that you can't really support the very concepts you use or Descartes uses to describe his own mind, except in a more social context. So that this idea that I have a mind but you don't somehow is undercutting its own conceptual history, something like that. I think it's called his private language argument. You couldn't really have a private language because it wouldn't be a language unless it had more general application, which would require a social setting. So is your view something like that?
Yeah, it is something like that. I think that's part of it, because I want to say that there are certain ways in which we come to develop our concepts of mind. So our concept of being in pain and having beliefs and all that. And I agree with Wittgenstein on that. But I think what's wrong with this scientific model is that we're making it a hypothesis that another has a mind. Right? Go back to some of the things you said at the beginning. Is it really a hypothesis that your friends and lovers, your family has a mind?
Well, but if it's not a hypothesis, a good, supportable, but questionable hypothesis, is it just a brute observation? I don't directly perceive John's mind. You and John both seem like you want to deny this asymmetry that we started out with. I mean, the behaviorists sort of want to deny the asymmetry. Wittgenstein wasn't a behaviorist, but he also seemed to want to deny it. But it's something to be explained, and they had an explanation for it, sort of. Ryle would say, well, I'm just around myself more. That's why I have more opportunities to observe myself more.
Ryle.
That seems wrong, that it's just a matter of more opportunities to observe myself. There seems to be some special cognitive relationship or something that I am to myself that I'm not to anybody else, and that gets the problem going. And you guys seem like you want to deny that. And how could you deny that?
Can I pick you up on that word perceive?
Okay, yeah.
I think that there's something there. I mean, sometimes we look at people and we see them kind of getting redder and redder in the face, and then they kind of shout out at us. And we think, whoa, I can see you're angry, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
I think we should try and work with that. Okay. Let's see if we can find a way of saying that minds aren't so obscure. They're not. And this is the real thing. I think we should stop thinking about behavior as masking our minds, as somehow getting in the way of our having a more kind of direct relationship to another mind.
So let's shift gears a little. Suppose we grant that other people have minds, and I go along with the idea that the premise that we know our own mind in this perfect way is a little bit shaky, even though we don't quite understand it because we only have so much time. But then there is this question about what other people are thinking, given that they're thinking. How much do we really know about what other minds are like? Do we know that their sensations are like ours? Or what, particularly if you're dealing with people with non-standard minds, people with autism or people who, like myself, are getting senile. How much can we really know about what's going on in their mind? I think Ken has a collar.
Yeah, we have a collar on just this point, John. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the problem of other minds. And Michael from Boston's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, hello. I'm what is called high-functioning autistic, and other people have never made any kind of sense to me, really, except in a visceral sense. rather in a visceral sense, they haven't made any sense to me. I've had to basically think out to try to figure out what other people are going to do in very many situations. And beside a general caveat that maybe this should be discussed apart from solipsism, you know, assuming that solipsism isn't true, I think an argument I've had, or I've often thought that I can't really believe in solipsism because I don't believe I'm clever enough to think up the behavior of the rest of the universe and other people being so different to me. I don't really think I could come up with the things they come up with.
So just let me interject an explanation. I don't think we've defined solipsism, but this is the view that theoretical philosophers who decide there aren't other minds holds. It's sometimes thought to be the position that Descartes really starts out with. So solipsism view that only I have a mind. You don't find many books defending solipsism, I think, because if you're a solipsist,
you
don't
have
the point of writing a book?
But
so
if you were a solipsist, even if you did have direct experience of another mind, you wouldn't trust that.
Yeah.
So
Michael,
why bother?
But
with it?
Let me ask you, Michael, with respect to understanding other people's minds, are you more confident in understanding, say, their beliefs and their desires than you are understanding their emotions and things like that, or is it all pretty much the same?
Actually, emotions are a little bit easier because I, like most, as far as I know, all artistic people, I actually do have most of the full set of them.
Mm-hmm.
But what motivates them, what they care about, I once casually remarked to someone, that's someone else's sex life. Why should I be interested in it?
Yeah.
When this seems to be one of the most absolutely interesting things to most other people.
Michael, thanks for the call. It's fascinating stuff, and we're so glad that you called in and shared this with us. Anita, this is big stuff in cognitive science. Some cognitive scientists argue that autism, they now think, is what's called a deficit in the model of mind module in our brains. Our brains have this built-in thing that enables us to either infer or interpret or perceive minds, the contents of the minds in others, and autistics have that broken somehow or other. What do you think about all that, about Michael's? I mean, what do you want to think about that whole territory?
Can I go back to a distinction that we started to make earlier on, this distinction between how I know that mm-hmm. others think and how I know what they think?
Yeah.
I'm not sure we know that others think that we're not alone in the world. I'm not sure that's a really good question. How do I know this? I think that we base our knowledge of, say, what they're thinking, we base it on something which is founded on the way we engage with others. Okay? We engage with others in a way which you might say just assumes that they're minded. And what I mean by this is that we respond differently to other people than we do to tables and chairs. At least normally we do. Yeah?
Yeah.
And psychologists are used to looking at infants now and saying that they talk about this, I think your roving reporter used this word, attuned. Yeah? A child is very responsive to its mother's or caregiver's smile. And that smile actually gets more confident as the mother's smile is also confident and strong. So we're seeing in very, very young infants some kind of attunement to others. Yeah. They're not reasoning that there are minds out there.
I think you're onto something really, really important. I think it maybe helps us to make sense of lots of different things. Again, autism involves a deficit in these special purpose capacities for reading minds, as it were, right? And if there's a kind of responsiveness to certain kinds of creatures, we can see that that capacity can be broken. We can see that that capacity develops. We can also see that that capacity may be overapplied. There's all these psychological experiments that will show that we apply these minded notions to objects that move in a certain way, even if they're not thinkers at all. So this there is some kind of maybe quasi-perception-like capacity in our brains that does this thing, which maybe...
Actually,
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
No,
I was just going to say, can I just pick up on what the caller said, which is he said, why should I be interested in this? That fundamental sense of our interest, that's, again, not something you teach somebody, right? That's something we come into the world with. And it could be that there is this deficit of engagement, okay? And when there's a sense of a lack of engagement, then other things are going to follow. Now, I might learn to read behavior, right? But when you learn to read behavior, you're not reading it from a sense of engagement. And I guess that seems to me a good way maybe of thinking about what's going on here. Yeah? At least something to play with. That it's this fundamental engagement that's somehow awry.
So we've got some interesting email from Brian in Boston that maybe we can close out this segment discussing, because it really brings up this question of the relation between the brain and the mind, and the relation between that question and the problem of other minds. And he says, uh-huh. A responsible inference would only get us to a justified belief in other brains, not other minds. How could an immaterial mind cause physical behavior? That seems to me like a pretty good question. I mean, what I find out about my own mind by introspection and the special ways about finding out about my own mind, does that really guarantee that my mind is the explanation for my behavior, as opposed to what science tells us, that the brain is the explanation for my behavior? I mean, how does that fit in with the problem of other minds?
Wait a minute, but the mind is just the brain working, isn't it? I'm not.
Well, could be. I mean, I wrote a book defending that, but that doesn't make it true, unfortunately.
So, Anita, do you have a thought about that? Briefly?
Yeah. I think this is really tough, and how the brain fits in here is anybody's guess still. But I'm not sure it can help us with how we know, because we haven't known a whole lot about the brain for a long time, but if you talk about common sense will tell us, I know that my daughter has a mind, right? And I think people have known that for a very long time.
Yeah.
Long before they knew anything about brains.
Yeah, this is tough stuff, and we're going to dig even deeper in our final segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the problem of other minds with Anita Avramides from the University of Oxford.
You may be pretty sure about your own mind. You may be confident about my mind. You may be even reasonably convinced of Ken's mind. But what about your cat? Or the snail in your garden? Or the robot you'll soon be able to order from Amazon? Or the intelligent drone that will deliver the robot you'll soon be able to order from Amazon? Or the interplanetary alien that just landed in your backyard? Do they have minds like yours? How are you going to tell?
The minds of philosophers, the minds of snails, and the minds of Martians. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Because your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime.
You may be talking to me, but is that evidence enough that your mind is not on permanent vacation? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Anita Avramides from the University of Oxford, author of the fine book, Other Minds.
Anita, when we're thinking about humans, it's pretty plausible that the problem of other minds is less a practical problem than a theoretical, philosophical one. But when we think about animals, especially those quite different than ourselves, or robots, or aliens, there do seem to be practical issues. I mean, there's ethical issues. Maybe there'll be voting rights issues when we have intelligent robots. I want to discuss how we go about deciding those. I'm not sure you have a position on this, but I'm sure you have insights about it.
Well, you know, this is hard. But I think we can say a few things, and we might even be able to use this split in questions that we were working with earlier, this knowledge that and knowledge what. Because I said that we, in our own case, we start with a kind of engagement, the way we react to other people. And I think that we react to other creatures similarly. Yeah, I think we react to our dog in a different way than we react to a table, right? So there's already a foundation here for thinking something's going on over there.
Well, yeah? But Nina, doesn't this raise the worry? Look, if our I'm going to put it crudely. We have an instinct to see things that are minded. We see things that are minded maybe that move a certain way. That's a kind of projective instinct we have. Mostly, nature has designed us so that the things that move in a certain way and behave in a certain way maybe are minded. So the instinct is reliable in the kind of home environment. But the aliens start invading, or we start living with these creatures. Doesn't the problem just come back? Why should we believe this instinct to project mind on the things is reliable? Again, there's all kinds of psychological experiments that show that you can trick this thing. So how do we know that the Martians or the robots aren't just tricking this instinct of ours?
Yeah. Well, again, maybe we can't. You know, I think part of the problem here is we want a kind of black and white answer. We want to know, do they or don't they have a mind, right? And I think we think minds are kind of all or nothing.
Yeah.
That's another problem. So we think there's this thing. Either they've got it and they've got the whole package, or they don't. And we maybe need to start thinking like that. Maybe they can feel a little bit. They can think a little bit.
I think that's right. And I think Hume distinguished between impressions and thoughts. And I always thought, well, you know, that's pretty persuasive, right? Thoughts, I think of as things that have content, truth conditions, usually having to do with objects in the world. And it's just very hard not to think of lots of things as having something like beliefs. I mean, computers, animals, because they seem to have the ability to pick up information, and then their behavior seems to be of a sort that makes use of that information. So to suppose that they're not information processing the way we are, and they don't have a picture of how the world is for me would be very hard with the kind of aliens we imagine. But do they have feelings?
Go back to our buddy Descartes, though.
You're going to put Descartes before the rest of the question,
yeah.
Huh?
The horse.
But go back to Descartes, because he had this argument, a morally certain argument that animals cannot think, mm-hmm. right? And that argument turned on, well, they can't use speech, then they don't have this reason as a universal instrument. But the point I wanted to make is that he actually taught us to think that mind is an all or nothing thing, because even, he says, the least of humans have this infinitory capacity for language and thought and have reason as a universal instrument. No animal has that. So that's you can imagine an automaton that could do some of the things that a minded human can do, but not all of the different things. And can do some of the things that we do better than we do, but we've got this universal instrument, and that's where mind is. So he had a really pretty high standard for what it takes to be minded. And I guess you guys are thinking that standard of his is way too high. That argument of his is way too demanding.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
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 I mean.
Sorry. I think it's too demanding. But a lot of you might be familiar with a paper that was written by Tom Nagel called What Is It Like to Be a Bat?
Yeah.
It's a really fantastic paper. And what's really interesting about it is we all say, yeah, he's right. There's something it's like to be a bat. How do we know that? Right? Why did he start with what is it like to be a bat? Well, I think it's because he says, well, actually, it would be immodest of us to think we're the only minds out, right? It's complete immodesty to think that. Now, what's really interesting is, I think if we take this line that I was suggesting, that you're quite right to, you know, take me up on about whether we can get it wrong and all that, but I think there is still a limitation. Even if we accept that we engage with creatures and might want to attribute a bit of mind to them, I don't think we can really see what it's like for them. I don't think we can know exactly what they're feeling. We can, to a certain extent, but we can't engage with them in the way in which we've developed our concepts so that we can really be sure that we're getting anything right about them. But we know that there's something going on over there. I think that's about all we can say. And in some cases, we can say a little bit more. But I'm not sure we have the perceptual capacities, if you want to talk in terms of seeing, to see in their minds. They've got to look a bit more like us that to work.
Now, my late friend, the great philosopher Fred Dretske, would say, well, actually, you can know what it's like to be a bat. Bats navigate through echolocation. We can know a lot about the properties of their perceptual system, what properties they're reacting to in the environment, and so forth and so on. And if we could really got not just their ability to perceive by echolocation, but all the other things they do, if we could understand them in terms of the kind of information that they're dealing with, according to Dretzky, there would really be no issue left over. And you're denying that. You think there'd still be this question of, well, but what's the raw feel involved?
No, I'm not so sure, actually. I'm wondering if this sort of fits with other things that Dretzky said, because I think in the case of us, mm-hmm. what Dretzky says is, look, we have some characteristic looks when we've got a headache. Mm-hmm. I can see because of this characteristic look that you have a headache. And I guess what I want to dispute is whether I can see in the sense of understand characteristic looks in the case of things like bats.
Right? Well...
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's an actual human being who he goes by the nickname of Superman, who actually can echolocate. You can watch a video of him on YouTube.
Oh.
And his brain is being studied out the wazoo because he can ride. He's blind. He's blind as a bat.
So you're not talking about the fictional Superman.
No,
you're talking
about a real person. About a real guy. So actually, maybe we can know what
does
it's like.
Does he ping? Does this guy
yes,
ping?
Yes, he clicks. He clicks. And he hears the clicks. He hears the delay. And he's really good at echolocating. But
too bad for Tom Nagel. Yeah, he's been empirically refuted.
Yeah, no, Nagel would say that's what it's like to be a human echolocating, not what it's
yes.
like to be a bat echolocating.
Yeah, there you go.
But I want to step back to Descartes for just one second. I love Descartes for many reasons, but I want to say something about his argument that morally certain argument that animals don't have minds or don't think anyway. Not so much the consequence, but one sort of side consequence of that argument, because he says wherever there's a little bit of mind, there's the totality of mind. Mindedness does not come in degrees. It couldn't because it's a simple kind of right. So, and that means that all humans. Every single human is equally minded, and so they have a kind of dignity, and, you know, he doesn't draw that conclusion, but they have a kind of equal dignity, equal worth, equal standing as a minded creature. There aren't different kinds of minds like the Aristotle mainly thought. I think that's kind of an advance in the history of philosophy. Do you guys disagree?
Well, it's an advance in the history of the Enlightenment and human freedom and conceptions
right.
of equality. However, was it true?
Well, you know, I think there's dignity and there's voting rights and then there's how you treat each other. You know, it may be that with your dog, you just don't go kicking them or depriving mm-hmm. them of food. That doesn't mean we have to give him voting rights.
Right.
Right. So it can be that we can modify our treatment to what we can engage with.
My own view is that men should not have voting rights because they're lesser evolved than women, but that's probably a topic for a different show.
I want to ask you one last question about seeing and perceiving. I'm kind of going to toy with this idea that our belief in other minds isn't like a scientific inference. It isn't just an analogical reasoning. It's some kind of something more like perception. And we have this complicated machinery that enables mental perception just as we do object perception. But here's the thing I worry about. When I say see, there's like just sort of directly seeing. I don't directly see. And then there's seeing that. I see that you're angry. I see uh-huh. that you're puzzled. But uh-huh. seeing that uh-huh. sounds like a form of... that sounds like a cheat because that sounds like believing on the basis of seeing. But then I don't know how it works. Right? I see your body, but now I see that you're angry. You know, it sounds like it's naming a solution, not really giving a solution.
Hmm.
Well, you might, yeah.
I didn't mean to cause silence.
I mean, you're right, because people who put this forward, like Dretzky, say, well, I can't see the headache, right? I just see that Sally has a headache. I don't see her headache. Because if I could see her headache, then I'd know solipsism was false. Yeah. And there's something odd about that, he says. Just like if you think about brains in vats, he said, when I see the table, I don't see that I'm not a brain in a vat. I think there's some room in that way of thinking to go back to there's something more fundamental about that, right? There's something that we have to take on to be on the table already, right?
Right.
It's not that I can see that. So I'm not sure it's a cheat. I think it's something that leaves room for us to get the story right.
So, well, you know, so now we're at the beginning where we can start getting the story right, but now we're at the end of the our show almost. So you know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to thank you for joining us and invite you to come back some other time, Anita.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Our guest has been Anita Avramides. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Oxford and author of the book Other Minds. So, John, now that I'm kind of more convinced that you have a mind after this hour, what is that mind thinking?
Well, it's interesting because I went to graduate school 1964, 1968, and the problem of other minds was big then. My teacher, Norman Malcolm, had just written a very influential essay criticizing from a Wittgensteinian point of view the argument from analogy. Then the problem is kind of disappeared. Well, not disappeared, but gone underground. Hasn't been a big problem for a while, but it's coming back. And our guest has this book, Other Minds. That means it's being taken seriously at Oxford. That's always a good sign that a problem thought dead is coming back to life.
Exactly. And if it's taken seriously at Oxford, it's taken seriously at Stanford. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, here's a mind that we know loves to move fast. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Descartes supposedly wondered if other people were really other people under their hats and coats, or if they're actually automatons created by malicious demons to fool us into thinking reality was really real. Descartes managed to convince himself that he existed via his famous deduction, cogito ergo sum, but he also wrote it down, which leads me to believe that he believed people were people after all, at least people enough to read his writing, although it could be that a malicious demon likes a good deduction as much as the next fellow. I always wondered, though, what should prevent a malicious demon from making you think that you're you when actually you're just a false consciousness? How do I know that it's me doing the thinking, not some thought projection from a master telepathic hypnotist who's also a psychopath? I think, therefore, I am would still be true, only the I wouldn't be me. It would be a malicious demon lying to himself for his own amusement, or rather for the amusement of the avatar he created to have something to fool. Yeah, take that, reality. Well, Descartes got in a bit of hot water with the Christian powers that be. He was called a blasphemer because the malicious demon he dreamt up for his thought experiment was using powers reserved for God himself. Though I would think if God dreamed up this false world for our perception, it would actually be the real world, wouldn't it? What also bugs me about this Cartesian reality being an illusion thing is the use of an automaton. If the demon is showing us a fake reality, why does it need to use a machine at all? Can't it be just like a dream? Why make us think we're looking at people? Why not unicorns or dragons? And rather than making us think we're seeing an automaton, why not just possess a real automaton, like the demon possessing the kid in The Exorcist? Of course, I am assuming that Descartes just made all this stuff up in the first place, which is why it was an automaton. He was drawing on what he knew. I mean, we've had automatons since ancient Greece. Everybody knew what they were. And now we have robots and androids. Everybody knows what those are. They became a real trope in the 21st century. Robots from the future looking human trying to destroy us. Descartes didn't know about aliens, otherwise he would probably have had them back in the 17th century, stealing our souls and taking over the planet. We also have the Matrix now, which kind of took the Cartesian notion and ran with it. Not only was reality manufactured for human consumption by machines, humans were being bred to keep the machines alive. I think. I only made it through two of the movies, or maybe I'm just making it up in my own head. I'd probably feel a lot better about the Matrix and solipsism if that were true. Plus, if I really am alone, making up a universe for my own personal amusement, that's depressing, but it's a great way to get out of an argument. How can you tell me I'm wrong? You don't even exist. I gotta go. Therefore, I am.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
You're reading a magazine, you come across a full-page nude photo of a girl. Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?